Well, this is the third Sabbath of the month, so we're going to continue our pattern of having a Bible study format. We have been working our way through the book of Acts, and we will cover another chapter here this afternoon. We found that Acts, in addition to being a book of history, early history of the church, it also is an important book in that it establishes a number of doctrinal points and also a lot of precedents or patterns for the church that were established in these early times and have been part of the church ever since. Christ had promised that he would build his church and it would never fail, and that church began on the day of Pentecost, as we know, in 31 AD, and has continued ever since and will continue on until the time that Christ returns. These early days are very interesting to look at and to consider, and again, important in the sense of establishing precedent for how the church functions and how it's organized in many ways, and also establishing a number of basic doctrinal points as well. I've reminded you a couple of times how the summary verse in Acts 1:8 explains or points out that the church would begin at Jerusalem and would expand from there to Samaria and to Judea and then to Samaria and then to all the nations from that point. So as we have tracked through the book of Acts, we've seen the progress of the church exactly in that way. It began in Jerusalem on that Pentecost morning, and it continued to grow throughout Judea, and then it reached into Samaria. And last time we were reading in chapter 14, which speaks of the first extensive journey by Paul as he went into the area of Galatia to establish churches in that region. And it was the first work or effort of the church in a formal way outside of the area of Israel itself. The church had, there were some who had come to Jerusalem to observe the Pentecost who went back home and were believers, and there were, in that sense, Christians scattered all throughout that part of the world. But as far as an effort to preach the gospel and to reach out to people, the trip or the journey that Paul took in the year 48 was the first mission of the church, the first effort of the church to teach the gospel outside of the nation of Israel. It was a very successful trip. We reviewed that last week as we went through chapter 14. And we come to the end of chapter 14, and just to pick up, running start at chapter 15, in verse 26 of chapter 14, he's talking about how they were returning at the end of their trip back to where they had begun. And so it says that from there, that is from Perga, and then Attalia, from there he says they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they had completed. So they returned to Antioch from where they had begun as they started that trip. Now, it's a little bit confusing at times because there actually are two cities named Antioch. This is the Antioch that is in the region of Syria. And you will sometimes see this city referred to as the Syrian Antioch. And the other Antioch, other city, if you have the map that I gave to you last time, you'll remember that there's a city called Antioch, which is north and west of Iconium in an area called Pisidia, and it is called Pisidian Antioch. So when they returned, they visited the Pisidian Antioch as they were on the trip. When they came back, they returned to Syrian Antioch, where they had begun or where they come from. Verse 27, when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. Again, it was a very exciting and a very productive trip. And Paul established churches in Iconium and in Derbe and in Lystra, and also in Antioch as well. So all throughout that region, many were called, and the work was done, and the churches were started in those areas. They are, of course, primarily Gentile regions, Gentile churches. And so this then represents another development in the church. Peter, had some 10 years earlier baptized Cornelius, and the work of that he had opened up the opportunity then for Gentiles to become part of the church. But now, through Paul and Barnabas, there have been a number of churches that have been established that are largely, in fact, mostly Gentile. There were Jews in those areas, and remember that Paul would always go into synagogues to first make contact and to begin to preach the gospel, but many Gentiles were called in those areas as well. It says in verse 28, they stayed there, that is in Antioch, a long time with the disciples. So they continued at their home base in Antioch after this work was completed. So we see here a significant development in the church. It began with Jews in Jerusalem on Pentecost. Over a short period of time, it began to open up to, the proselytes were also included. Proselytes, of course, are Gentiles who have converted to Judaism. And it was quite an involved process. To be a proselyte would require men to be circumcised. And then they would participate in some ceremonial washings. And then finally, they would offer sacrifices. And all this had to be done at the temple in Jerusalem. So for a Gentile to convert to the religion of Judaism, it in effect required them, and this is all, this process was laid out in the Old Testament, but they were required to actually become part of the Jewish nation, to become part of Jew, to become a Jew in order to participate in the Jewish religion. And the early church included also Samaritans. Now, Samaritans were in a region just north of Jerusalem, and this area was kind of half Jewish. Remember that when the Jews were taken out of that region, there were Gentiles who were brought in to replace the Jews that had been taken into captivity, but there was a remnant of Jews who remained in Samaria. And so they became, they adopted a kind of a semi-Jewish religion, which the Jewish people themselves viewed with contempt, because they claimed to be of Jacob and a descendant of Jacob. Really they were kind of a half-Jew or a semi-Jewish people, and the Jews in Jerusalem were not very pleased with them, as they claimed to be Jews. But now, again, through Cornelius and then through the work of Paul and Barnabas, we have a number of Gentiles who have been added to the church. So the question that the church was faced with was, how do we deal with these Gentiles as they become part of God's church? Is an issue of salvation. How is salvation going to be granted? What is necessary for the Gentiles to do to receive salvation? The Jews were very concerned about this issue. You'll recall that they looked down with contempt on Gentiles in general. And now they're becoming part of the church. So what is necessary, what is required of a Gentile convert? Must a Gentile convert become a Jew first so that he can become a Christian? There were many of those who held that belief at this point. So it was a serious and important question for the church to deal with. We understand, certainly, that God's calling is open to all people from all races and all cultures. That's something that we kind of take for granted, because it's always been that way in the church that we know. But for the Jews and the early church, the view of Gentiles or having Gentiles become part of the church changed everything. And it is an issue that carries throughout, especially Paul's writings in the New Testament, that there was a controversy and a difficulty and a conflict between the Jews and the Gentiles. So this chapter 15 carries on from chapter 14, that after the work that Paul and Barnabas had done, and others learned of it. Reading chapter 15, verse 1, certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren that unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So the Jewish belief, at least among some, certain men, was that it was a requirement for the Gentiles to be circumcised. And unless they were, they could not receive salvation. That is, of course, a huge statement, and it became certainly a concern to the Gentiles. There's no indication that Peter brought that matter up at all with Cornelius, nor Paul and Barnabas with those churches that they established in Galatia. But now, these were coming in and making that claim or that statement to the Gentiles who had become part of the church. Now these teachers came from Jerusalem, and they were members of the church. We'll see that in just a moment as we continue. These were members of the church who were coming up to Antioch and making this claim to the Gentiles. Now, I said they came up. In verse 1, it says that they came down from Judea. Well, on a map, you'll see that Jerusalem is south of Antioch. And so from our perspective, the way we are oriented, if you travel north, you're going up. If you travel south, you're going down. That's not the way that they considered it in this culture. Jerusalem was the center and the capital of the nation. There was some elevation to the city. Remember, it was built on Mount Zion, the Mount of Olives. So there was some elevation to it. But in their eyes, in their view, Jerusalem was such an important place that it was above everything else. And whenever you went to Jerusalem, you went up. Whether you were traveling from the north or south, you were going up to Jerusalem. And whenever you departed from Jerusalem for some other location, you were going down. So they came down from Judea to give this teaching to these Gentile members. So they were teaching that the Gentiles needed to become a Jew in order to become a Christian. And unless they did so, they would not be allowed, they would not receive salvation. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, so this created quite a controversy in the church. Paul and Barnabas argued with them, and there was no small dissension. In other words, there was great turmoil and disagreement. The word dispute means commotion or strife or discord. They were arguing vehemently with these who were claiming to the newly converted Gentiles that they must be circumcised in order to receive salvation. So this went on for some time, and there was no small amount of commotion and strife among the church, among the people. So they determined that Paul and Barnabas and others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about this question. Now, there are some matters in life that are personal choice, and that we can have different opinions on, and it doesn't really matter. But this was not a matter of personal choice. There could not be confusion in the church. They couldn't apply this matter in one way in one place and another way in a different congregation. This was something that needed and required a formal decision to define what the church's belief is on this subject. So it had to be resolved. What they locally determined in Antioch was that Paul and Barnabas, who were the leading ministers in that congregation, and some others, would go to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders to seek a resolution to the question. This implies, or this shows us, that there was organization and leadership in the church. There was a way to get an answer, and that was to go to the headquarters where the apostles and elders were to get a resolution to the question. It implies the structure and the leadership of the church. There's often some question about that. How was the early New Testament church organized? And many would claim that it was a bunch of small local independent congregations, and they functioned separately from one another, very loosely knit together by these traveling apostles or evangelists. And there are some who view that as a model for the way the church should be today, that we should all be independent congregations and not be tied together to some central leadership or authority. But we see here that from the very beginning, there was a central leadership. There was authority. There was a way to get things resolved for the entire church. And that was through, again, the apostles and elders at Jerusalem. So being sent on their way by the church, that is by the church at Antioch, they passed through Phoenicia and Samaria, describing the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy to all the brethren. So as they made their journey, they were, I'm not sure how long it would have taken to travel from Samaria down to, or from Antioch, I should say, down to Jerusalem. But along the way, they met with fellow members of the church and possibly spent a Sabbath or two on their travel, and they explained what they were doing, why they were going to Jerusalem, and what work they had been involved in doing. News in these areas at this time didn't spread instantly over the internet, but when a visitor came through your village who was part of your church, you would want to know what's new, what's happening, and people would gain information from those who were traveling through the region. And so Barnabas and Paul shared with the people what they had done, the work that God had done in them and through them, and what had been accomplished in Galatia. The people certainly would have already known about the Gentiles who were added to the church by Peter. And so this added to their understanding of the growth of the church. Verse 4, when they had come to Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and the elders, and they reported all the things that God had done with them. Interesting to note the three different groups here that are mentioned. They were received by the church, that is, by the church in a general sense, by the members of the church. They were well received, they were welcomed, and what was going to be discussed in these meetings was something that the church was aware of. So they were received by the church. They were received by the apostles. Of course, the apostles, for the most part, were still in Jerusalem in these early years. This, by the way, took place in 49. This was the year 49 when this conference took place. So the apostles had not yet scattered from Jerusalem to other parts to take the message to other parts. Maybe not all of the original 12 were there, but there were certainly some of the apostles that were there in Jerusalem, or they came back to Jerusalem for the conference because such an important decision was going to be made. They were received by the church, by the apostles, and the elders. So this also implies then that there was a there was a already in place the office or the responsibility of elder in the church, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. The members were involved to some extent in these discussions. They were not involved in making the decision. They may have been able to listen in and to witness the discussions that took place in the conference, but it was something that was done, in a sense, openly, so the members were aware of it. A couple of years ago, a number of elders gathered in Louisville to discuss the forming of the Church of God, a worldwide association. And that we gathered in the hotel there in Louisville, and many members came to witness what was happening. There was a section of the auditorium that was set up in the back where members were able to listen in as the elders were discussing certain matters and certain things were being organized and decided. Many others were able to listen in via the internet. There were webcasts of the conference meetings as well. So the members were aware. They knew what was happening. Perhaps it was something like that, where the members were aware of it, certainly very concerned about what was happening, and able to at least listen in. And in some cases, between the various sessions and the meetings we had, the members would come and ask questions and make suggestions, and we would have input from them directly. So it was at least somewhat comparable to that kind of a setting when Paul and Barnabas came and the elders and the apostles gathered in Jerusalem for this discussion. Verse 5 says, "But some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up, saying, 'It is necessary to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses.'" There were later some Jews from outside the church who taught the requirement of circumcision. These are often referred to as Judaizers. They were those who required or tried to require that New Covenant Christians continue to observe the laws of Judaism. There were many of those from outside the church who tried to impose that on the church. Paul seems to have been dealing with those kinds of individuals when he wrote the book, the epistle to the Galatians. But here in verse 5, we see that in this case, the issue was raised by some who had come into the church from the sect of the Pharisees. These were church members of the sect of the Pharisees who believed. So these individuals, having been Pharisees in the past, were very legalistic in their opinions and very literal and strong in their opinions. And in this matter of circumcision, they agreed with the Judaizers. They felt that it was necessary for the Gentiles, as they were converted, to be baptized, as we had seen in verse 1. So there was this contention that came about. And so, verse 6, the apostles and the elders came together to consider this matter. So again, we see that the church was involved to the extent of being aware of what the discussion was about, but it was the apostles and the elders who would make the decision. Again, the office of elder was clearly already established. And again, this implies that there was structure, there was leadership that was established even in these very early years of the church. It was 18 years after the church had been born on that Pentecost morning. We see that there are both elders and apostles in these positions of authority, and they would together make the decision. The Jewish community, religious or secular, was certainly accustomed to the concept of elders being part of what they were part of the leadership of their church, or of their nation, and their culture. And Jesus referred to elders of the Jewish community in Matthew 15, verse 2. Matthew 15, verse 2, where Jesus says, "Why do your disciples," or actually the scribes came and Pharisees came to Jesus in verse 1. And in Matthew 15, verse 2, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat." So the Jewish culture, or the Jewish nation, was familiar with the concept of elders who were leaders in the community or leaders in the synagogue. Generally speaking, an elder was considered to be a counselor, an older individual, more mature, who would be able to take the lead and to give direction to others. The word elder is first used in regard to the church in Acts 11, verse 30. Acts 11, if you start back in verse 27, you see the context, that there was a prophecy or prediction of a great famine that would spread throughout the region. Verse 29, "Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This they did and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul." So there were elders in the church who had the responsibility of distributing these donations that were made to support the members in need in Judea. When Paul and Barnabas traveled through when they traveled through these cities in Galatia and established the churches, they organized them, and they selected men to be elders in the church. Acts 14, verse 23. Acts 14, 23. "When they had appointed elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord." So the office or the responsibility of an elder was one that was defined and established early in the development of the church. And working together, the elders had the responsibility to help to make the decision that was necessary regarding this question of circumcision. One more passage or thought on elders in general, 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, and remember, of course, that Peter is the apostle who is very central to this discussion, and who knew Jesus very well and was one of the original disciples, and he writes this epistle. So in 1 Peter 5, verse 1, Peter writes, "The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ." So Peter was an apostle, of course, but he considered himself as well to be an elder. He had the responsibility of working with the churches, and he had a special responsibility as an apostle. So apostles were elders, but not all elders were apostles. But it was a matter of selection. And as Paul wrote in both 1 Timothy and in Titus, it's a matter of ordination and a matter of giving them certain responsibilities. Chapter 5, continuing in verse 2 here in 1 Peter, Peter exhorts the elders to shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers. So the responsibility of an elder in the church was not exactly the same as an elder in the Jewish community. But they were called elders because they were to be spiritual leaders and overseers in the churches. And so they were given that responsibility, and Peter here reminds the elders to do so in a way that serves the people and not to serve themselves, and so on. So we find that admonition to the elders. So back to Acts chapter 15 again. When the elders and the apostles gathered together, they did so serving as the leaders of the church, upon whom rested the responsibility of making this decision for the church and what would be enforced or what would be the doctrine of the church on this matter. So we're continuing then in verse 7. When there had been much dispute, Peter rose up and began to speak. Again, there was a lively, a spirited discussion. There were strong opinions on both sides, and even arguing about which point of view the church should adopt. The arguments and the views, the opinions from both sides apparently were completely aired. People who had had an opinion, the elders and the apostles had the opportunity to make their case, to state what they believed. And it was not something that they agreed upon. There was great dispute among them. So as this continued, and by the way, this chapter, of course, is just a summary. The conference itself may have continued over a matter of several days. It doesn't say how long all this took. But there was time for all to make their points, to have their say. And then, after others had been speaking about this for some time, Peter made his statement. He rose up and he said to them, "Men and brethren, you know that a good while ago God chose among us that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe." Not everything in the book of Acts is clearly dated, so it's a little bit hard to know exactly when everything took place, but the conversion of Cornelius recorded in chapter 10 probably was in about the year 38. That's probably when that occurred. As you look at the flow of the book. So it had been a number of years, maybe 9 or 10 years, since Peter had worked with Cornelius. And he's reminding them that God had chosen him, and it was by him and through him that the Gentiles began to receive the gospel. So God, who knows the heart, acknowledged them by giving them the Holy Spirit, just as he did to us, and made no distinction between us and them, purifying their hearts by faith. Peter relates his experience, and he points out that God made no separation or no distinction between Jews and Gentiles. Now, the Jews had a very distinctive point of view, that they separated themselves from the Gentiles. They did not accept them. They viewed them in some ways in almost a racist way. They were very negative toward the Gentiles. But Peter makes the point that God made no distinction between us and them, pointing out that their view of God and the view of the Gentiles was not really appropriate. And he purified their hearts by faith, not by circumcision, but by faith. And it was the faith of the Gentiles in the sacrifice of Christ, the calling that they were given, that their minds were opened, and they were forgiven of their sins, just like the Jews were, and they were purified by faith. So Peter concludes in verse 10 his thought. He says, "Now therefore, why do you test God?" God's already made his will known, is what Peter is implying here. God has already made it clear that he finds no distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles. And that was made clear 10 years ago by the conversion of Cornelius and his household, without requiring circumcision. So why, then, Peter is asking, are you second-guessing God now? Why are you questioning the way that he has made it clear to us? So why do you test God by putting a yoke on the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? Commentaries, of course, immediately jump to the conclusion that the yoke that is spoken of here is the law. That what they were doing was trying to put the yoke of the law on the neck of the disciples. But this is a case where you need to consider a number of scriptures, not just the one statement. All by itself, you really don't know exactly what Peter is referring to. But when you look at the way that God's law is presented and the way that God's law is applied, you quickly see that there is no place in Scripture. There is no place in Scripture where God's law is called a yoke. So this is not referring to the basic law of God. Of course, you know, 1 John 5:3 comes to mind. This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not a burden. So the commands of God are not the yoke that Peter is referring to. Remember, Peter was dealing with the reasoning of people who were Pharisees. Converted, yes, they were in the church, but their background was, their reasoning was, their approach was from the view of Pharisees. That was their background. So let's go back to Matthew 23 and be reminded of what Jesus said about the approach of the Pharisees. Verse 4. Well, it says in verse 1, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. In other words, they have responsibilities for the people. So whatever they tell you to do, do it. And in other words, follow their leadership, because they had still that position of leadership at the temple. But look at verse 4, and here's the key to what Peter is talking about. For they bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders. The Pharisees had made God's law a burden. Even the Sabbath itself. You're familiar with all the silly things that they enforced about the Sabbath, about how much they were allowed to carry and how far they were allowed to walk and what they were allowed to heat or cook, and just the things they were allowed to do or not do. The Pharisees had created this yoke, this burden, that was impossible for anyone to live up to. The Pharisees had actually analyzed the covenant. They had found, I forget the exact number, a little over 600 specific commandments within the covenant. And each one of them was detailed and expanded upon and made to be something that the people were required to live up to. Now, obviously, we should observe the covenant. But they had made and taken the law of God and in other ways, including the Sabbath, and made it such a difficult, burdensome way of life. Now, these were converted Pharisees, as I said. These were Pharisees, it says in Acts 15, who were believers. But they were still exercising this same kind of Pharisaical reasoning and legalistically requiring things of the Gentiles that were not reasonable. It was a matter of salvation by what you did, not salvation by faith. Whenever anyone tries to make himself right with God, if you think you have to earn salvation rather than receiving God's grace, then you have just put upon yourself an unbearable yoke, because no one can ever earn salvation. Or what we do is not what in his physical works is not what will bring us salvation. That is impossible to live up to. God, again, saved them because of their faith. They were purified by their faith. So, the system of do's and don'ts and laws that had been created that really distorted the intent of God's law was the burdensome yoke which no one could live up to. Remember, Paul wrote later in the book of Romans that circumcision is of the heart, and that we are Jews inwardly, not outwardly. So the yoke that is placed, that is not necessary here, that Peter is speaking of, is not the law of God, but it is the distortion of the law of God, which had been imposed by the Pharisees. But we believe that through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, we shall be saved in the same manner as they. Peter kind of subtly turns this around the other way, doesn't he? That we'll be saved in the same way that they're saved. So he's kind of looking to their salvation and kind of putting them in the lead there in the way that he makes in that phrase. That the grace of God is what we will be saved by in the same manner as they are saved by God's grace. So the group listened, the apostles, the elders, those in the church who were witnessing this, verse 12, all the multitude kept silent. Remember, there was all this disputing, all this arguing that was going on, and now Peter has made his statement, and Peter carries a lot of weight. He's a leading apostle, one that they look up to and respect. He's made his point of view clear, and people are quiet as they contemplate, as they think about what it is that Peter has just said. So they were quiet, and then they listened to Barnabas and Paul declaring how many miracles and wonders God had worked through them among the Gentiles. After Peter spoke, it was quiet as people contemplated and gave thought to what Peter had said. And then the other two apostles, Barnabas and Paul, made their case. Now we should just remember that there were three apostles who had worked with the Gentiles to this point: Peter, Barnabas, and Paul. And so the three of them were in the best position to describe what had happened, what they had seen, what God had done. And so after Peter spoke, then Barnabas and Paul made their case on this matter. Now, it's often important the order in which names are listed. It says that Barnabas and Paul spoke to them. Because of Paul's history in Jerusalem, because of the many years that he persecuted the church in Jerusalem, it seems logical that Barnabas should go first. Barnabas had a lot more credibility. By this time, of course, Paul was recognized as one of the apostles, but still, as far as his street cred was concerned, Barnabas went a long ways. And so he was the first of the two to speak, but they both made their case in terms of what they had experienced. It doesn't say exactly what they said. It gave us a summary of Peter's statement, but it just says of Paul and Barnabas that they spoke of the miracles and the wonders that God had worked through them in working with the Gentiles. Verse 13, and then they became silent again. So there was this period of time, and exactly what that means, who knows? Did they take a break? Did they just go sit quietly? In times past at ministerial conferences, we've been instructed that we should go from the meeting room back up to our rooms to pray before a decision was made. Maybe something on that order was what this silence was about. But at any rate, it gave them time to think over and to reach some conclusions. So then James answered in verse 13. Again, I don't think that this was entirely James' decision. There was more than likely some further discussion among the apostles themselves and the elders to come to this conclusion, but James summarized the decision that they had come to. He's obviously a leader among the apostles. We believe that he was probably the pastor of the church, the congregation at Jerusalem. According to Expositor's commentary, James was known as an ascetic and as one who was very scrupulous in keeping the law. So in that sense, he would appeal to those who had more of the legalistic point of view. He was known to be very detailed and supportive of the legal requirements of God's law. However, it's also clear that James was open-minded to the events as they were unfolding and saw there was something greater here that was happening beyond just the immediate legalistic approach. So James answered and said, "Men and brethren, listen to me. Simon has declared how God at the first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name." First of all, James refers to Peter as Simon. Simon is Peter's Hebrew name. So by referring to him as Simon, James is subtly emphasizing that the man we know better as Peter was himself a faithful Jew, that his heritage and his belief and his where he came from was where all the rest of us have come from. He was Jewish. So Simon has explained to us what God did through him. Again, Peter's experience and Peter's report, Peter's opinion carried a great deal of weight. And so James refers to him and to what he had stated. Notice also, he first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. The Jews considered themselves God's people. They were the people of God. They were the only people on earth, so far as they experienced and they believed, that were worthy of the name of God being upon them. James is pointing out that God has taken from the Gentiles, called from the Gentiles, people, or a people, upon whom he will place his name. Then James cites a prophecy which indicates that God always intended to establish the Gentiles as part of his plan. They were to be part of his kingdom. He quotes from Amos 9, verses 11 and 12. Which says this: "After this, I will return and will rebuild the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. I will rebuild its ruins. I will set it up so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord who does all these things." James is reminding the Jewish members of the church that it was always God's plan, always God's intent, to include the Gentiles in his kingdom and in his way of life and to place his name upon them. Remember, there's a prophecy in Isaiah that says that there will be a highway between Assyria, Egypt, and Israel, and that it would be implied then that the unity of those three nations living and dwelling together in peace. It's significant that the people of Egypt and the people of Assyria maintain their Gentile identities. In the millennium, they don't become Jews. They're still Assyria, and they're still Egypt. But they're converted Assyria and converted Egypt. And so the implication is that it's not necessary to become a Jew to be a Christian. That God always intended, and he will fulfill, and in fact, the implication here is that God has begun to fulfill that part of his plan of drawing the Gentiles in and placing his name upon them. James is clearly in agreement with Barnabas and with Paul and with Peter in their view on this question. Verse 18, known to God from eternity are all his works. It's a little bit of an awkwardly phrased statement, but generally, basically what it's saying is that we cannot oppose God's will. God, from his position and his authority, ruling over eternity, knows what he's doing, and he will accomplish his will. We don't always understand it, but God knows what he's doing, and he will make sure that it all fits together. James has created then a picture that takes these Jews from where they are to actually well into the future when all of the Gentiles will be given an opportunity. And he's implying then in his reasoning that God has begun that process now, that God has clearly begun to place his name upon the Gentiles, and that he is offering them their opportunity for salvation by grace, just as he has offered it to the Jewish people. Verse 19. Therefore, so here's the conclusion. Based on everything we've talked about, everything that's been presented, both sides of the story have been related, arguments have been made by everyone who has a different opinion and point of view, but taking into consideration what I see, what we see, the apostles and the elders have decided, and James makes the proclamation, but it's a decision of the apostles and elders, therefore we should not trouble those from among the Gentiles who are turning to God. That's the conclusion, that not to add any more difficulty upon them by requiring circumcision as they are in the process of turning to God. He took into consideration how God had worked through them, or worked with them through the apostles, the fruit of what had happened, and the fact that, you know, when Cornelius was baptized some 10 years before, there was no requirement of circumcision on him and his household. And so it does not make sense, is the conclusion, that this requirement should be added to what it already takes for them to turn to God. But, verse 20, that we write to them to abstain from all things, or from things polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from things strangled, and from blood. Now those are four areas of parts of the Gentile world that they had to come out of. These were common practices among the pagans and among the Gentiles. The first two, of course, are sinful. Idols, or idolatry, and sexual immorality are direct breaking of the Ten Commandments. From things strangled and from blood, it's more of a, it's still part of the Old Covenant that those things should be avoided, but there are things that were, again, commonly practiced among the pagans in terms of their sacrifices and in the way that they ate, and they would be especially repulsive to the Jews. And so these are four specific areas that are particularly part of the Gentile practice, which they needed to be reminded to come out of. Some maintain that these were the only four things that Gentiles needed to do to receive salvation. That, of course, is just silly. It's not logical. God has not given the Gentiles a different law or different set of requirements than he's given to others. Again, these are specific areas that the Gentiles would have to come out of in order to become part of the church, things that were part of the typical Gentile practice. So they're being specifically reminded of those in particular, that they must not continue in those practices. Verse 21, for Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Again, you see, James is pointing out that these four points of overcoming need to be emphasized to the Gentiles, and the rest they will learn as they're taught every Sabbath. When you came into the church, there was probably one particular issue or subject that got your attention in the first place, that drew you into the church. In many cases, people began to study prophecy, or they realized there was something wrong with the holidays that people were observing, or it was the Sabbath, or some question about heaven or hell. Whatever it might have been, there was most likely one area that was really important to you that you studied and that this church taught something different about than what you had seen, and you believed it, and it drew you into the church. And then you learned the rest later. You learned the rest as you continued along. And that's essentially what James is saying here about the Gentiles. They need to be reminded to give up this lifestyle that they've been part of. And as they come and are part of what we are, then they're going to learn the rest as they go. And as you read Paul's epistles that are written primarily to Gentile churches in Philippi or Colossae or Thessalonica or Rome, there's a great deal of emphasis on obedience to God's law, far beyond these four starting reminders. So, the decision was made, and the understanding that, you know, they'll learn the rest as they continue. So, verse 22, then it pleased the apostles and the elders with the whole church. They made a doctrinal decision, something that there was controversy about, something that was difficult perhaps for some to accept or to understand. But when the decision was made, then the apostles, the elders, the whole church were pleased. And again, that's an example of something that should be the way that we can deal with issues in the church as well. I doubt that absolutely every single individual was just delighted with the decision that was made, but it was a decision that was accepted. And they were willing to go forward from that point with that as the teaching of the church. So it pleased the apostles and the elders with the whole church. And they sent chosen men of their company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. The men were Judas, whose name also was called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men among the brethren. James and the apostles did something very, that was very, very helpful here. You see, if Paul and Barnabas by themselves had returned to Antioch to announce the decision of the church, there may well have been some of the Jews in the congregation who would kind of roll their eyes and say, well, yeah, sure, that's what you believed all along, and so you come back and you tell us that that's what the church has decided. I guess I shouldn't judge them, but it's kind of human nature. Because they knew that Paul and Barnabas were not in favor of the Gentiles having to be circumcised. But rather than send them back by themselves with the news of the decision of the church, they sent with them men that were leading men among the brethren, men that were well known, Barnabas and Silas, and they were then able to confirm the report and to convey to the churches in Antioch and in that region what the church's decision was. So, they wrote this letter that went with them as well. So James sent a letter. I'm sorry, I kind of lost my place here. They sent a letter with the four men, with Paul, Barnabas, Barsabbas, and Silas. This is the letter, and it's a very well-written letter. You see a lot of, in the tone of the letter, that helps convey the intent and the decision of the church. It says, the apostles, the elders, and the brethren, to the brethren of the Gentiles in Antioch, Syria, and Cilicia. James opens the letter by, in effect, welcoming the Gentiles as brethren, as fellow members. It's from your brethren in Jerusalem to you, our brethren, in Antioch, Syria, and Cilicia. So it's a carefully worded letter that makes it clear to the Gentiles from the very outset that they are brethren, that they are considered part of the church. Again, you might want to consider how the people in these areas up in Galatia were concerned and anticipating what the answer might be. This was going to be a big deal. Because if the answer came back that they needed to convert to become proselytes and then become Christians, that was going to add a whole different level of need on them. They were going to have to travel to Jerusalem to go through the whole process, and the men were going to have to go through the very painful experience of circumcision. It made things so much more complicated and difficult. It was already enough that they had come out of their culture, out of their society, and made this leap of faith to become part of the church in the first place. And now they were faced with the possibility of having to do much, much more. So whatever the decision was going to impact their lives. So they were very anxious to hear the news. And it must have already given them some sense of relief to note the way that the letter opens. To our brethren of the Gentiles in Antioch, Syria, and Cilicia, greetings. Since we've heard that some who went out from us have troubled you with unsettling your soul, saying you must be circumcised and keep the law, that is the law of circumcision, to whom we gave no such commandment. By the way, we didn't send those folks to you. They came of their own. They took matters into their own hands and came up to try to make their case. I think that teaches us a little bit of something about the process of making doctrinal or decisions within the church as well. These people took it upon themselves to make this doctrinal decision, and they were wrong. And they caused a great deal of confusion in the church. And so they did something that was improper, and it was confusing and unsettling to these members. And they were not sent by the apostles, by the church, to deliver that message. They took it upon themselves. So, since we're aware that this has happened, it seemed good to us, verse 25, being assembled with one accord, to send chosen men to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul. In that phrase, with our beloved Barnabas and Paul, James also makes it clear that he supports, the apostles support Barnabas and Paul. That these are men that we feel have done, are beloved by the church and by the leadership, and supports them. Because I'm sure that because of the controversy, there was some division in the church. Some there probably didn't think as highly or were not as respectful of Barnabas and Paul because they held a different opinion than what they had. Barnabas and Paul, men who have risked their lives for the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Again, acknowledging the work that they've done and the efforts that they've put forward. Remember Paul, we read in chapter 14, I forget which one of those three cities they visited, he was actually stoned and left for dead. And they were gathered around looking at his seemingly dead body, wondering, what are we going to do now? And then he popped up and they walked into town. he had proven his dedication and his courage. And James relates that and makes reference to it. We've therefore sent Judas and Silas, who will report the same things by word of mouth. So these other leading men, we're going to be sent to them as well to bring this this report to them of what the church had decided. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. In other words, they were led by the Holy Spirit to make this decision, to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things. And he relates the four points that were pointed out before, a little different order here, but the same four points, that you abstain from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. Again, reminding them to come out of that lifestyle that they had been part of, and to continue their process of commitment and of learning and of complying with God's law. So with that, if you keep yourselves from these, you do well. You're off to a good start. You've made that commitment and you're on your way. And then he says farewell. So the letter was very encouraging and very helpful to them, reminding them of the standards they needed to begin to meet and to live up to, and to continue in their commitment to make the changes that brought them out of one lifestyle into God's way of life. So when they were sent off, they came to Antioch, and when they had gathered the multitude together, they delivered the letter. When they read it, they rejoiced over its encouragement. I would imagine they were greatly relieved that here's the answer. And they understood it. This is probably the answer that at least the Gentiles were anticipating and hoping for. There were Jews in the area as well who were part of those congregations. They were mostly Gentiles, but there were Jews there as well. Doesn't say how they responded to it, how they reacted, but hopefully it was with understanding too. So when they'd read it, they rejoiced over its encouragement. Now, Judas and Silas themselves, being prophets also, exhorted and strengthened the brethren with many words. Being prophets does not necessarily mean that they were predicting future events, but they were speaking under inspiration. After they had stayed there for a time, they were sent back with greetings from the brethren to the apostles. However, it seemed good to Silas to remain there. So Barsabbas is the one who returned, and Silas remained. Paul and Barnabas also remained in Antioch, teaching and preaching the word of the Lord with many others also. By the way, all that was required of the Gentiles were those four things that were listed in that letter, then what do Paul and Barnabas need to teach? I mean, they continued with them, expounding on God's word, preaching to them, teaching them, taking them beyond those initial starting points of those four points that were made to them to help them continue in learning about their new commitment. So clearly, there's much more to the need, what they needed to do, than just those four things that are listed. Verse 36, so some time passes. After some time had passed, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. So Paul decided it was time to return then back to Galatia to visit the churches that they had established, to encourage them, to strengthen them, and to check in with them to see how they're doing. Paul was not just one who went out and raised up churches, but he was one who had the who wanted to shepherd and to pastor and to care for those people as well. So Barnabas apparently agreed, and Barnabas was determined to take with them John, called Mark. But Paul insisted they should not take him with them, the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone on with them to the work. Remember in Acts 14 that John, Mark, had abandoned them in the middle of the trip. Doesn't say why in Acts 14, but he had, while they're in Pamphylia, decided that he was not going to continue the journey. We pointed out then, in that case, that from that point on the southern edge of the continent, just off the Aegean Sea, they were going up into Antioch, which was a long journey over mountainous land, and it was sometimes dangerous as well. So maybe Mark just kind of bailed out and decided that, no, this is, I'm not up to this. I don't want to take that. I'm not ready to go into that kind of a situation. And, of course, we see even what happened later to Paul, that it was very dangerous. So maybe Mark got homesick. Maybe he just didn't have the strength or the mettle to continue. But in Paul's view, he just abandoned them. And that really upset him. So Paul said, no, he cannot come with us because he's not trustworthy. Last time we had him along, he quit in the middle of the trip, and it probably caused some disruption, and Paul was not willing to travel with Mark. So the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and went on his journey. So here we have two apostles, two deeply converted Christians who have a serious disagreement. However, they disagree very strongly, but they do apparently seem to maintain their respect for one another. They went on different trips, but there's no split here. There's no division. There's no separation. They continue in the same work. They continue doing the same with the same effort. They continue with the same message. They're still part of the same church and the same work of the church. But because of this disagreement, they decide the best thing to do is just you go your way and I'll go the other. Who was right? Was Barnabas right? Was Paul right? Well, probably they both were right. They both had a good point. Paul had genuine concern that Mark was untrustworthy, that he had quit on them on the previous trip. And so he was not willing to take that chance again. Very likely, his strong opinion on this matter helped Mark to learn the lesson that he needed to be more trustworthy. It probably was a very and he did prove himself. You see later that Mark and Paul traveled together. I think it's the book of Colossians where they're mentioned as traveling together. Mark had to prove himself once again before Paul would be willing to trust him. And that probably was good for Mark to realize that the seriousness of the mistake that he had made. But Barnabas was right also, because he encouraged Mark by giving him another chance, by giving him an opportunity to prove himself, which he did. And this is not a doctrinal matter. This is a relationship issue. And it's essential that we have agreement doctrinally, as we saw earlier in the chapter with the decision on circumcision. But this was a matter that needed to be resolved in a different way. And eventually it was resolved. But for now, what was best was for them to travel separately. So Paul and Silas, it says, went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. That's as far as we're going to go then this afternoon. When we pick it up at our next Bible study, I think we'll be able to pick up the pace, because from this point forward, we find more of an account of what happened. It's less, a little easier to review and to follow the story from this point forward. I hope that we see, as we've gone through the first half of the book of Acts, that there are a number of events and circumstances and decisions and patterns that are set, that are established for the church and for us to learn from, for us to follow, and also some doctrines that are confirmed, as well as a very inspiring and uplifting account of what it was like for the church in those early years, and some of the major players, so to speak, and the leaders in the church, in particular Peter, Paul, Barnabas, James, and others that we see God using to lead and to form his church. So we'll break it off there, and next time we have a Bible study, we'll pick it up in chapter 16.
Thank you, Mr. Henson.